You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
On Brand is brought to you by the Brand Driven Digital Event Series, featuring Digital Strategy Bootcamp. This day-long, intensive, and interactive workshop helps you ground your digital marketing with a solid strategy that you can share with your team. Learn more and register now at branddrivenbootcamp.com.
Welcome to On Brand, a podcast for brand builders by brand builders. Here's your host, Nick Westergaard of Brand Driven Digital.
Hey, brand builders, have we got a show for you? Today's guest is Andrew Davis. Andrew's 20-year career has taken him from local television to the Today Show. He's worked for the Muppets in New York. He's marketed for tiny startups and Fortune 500 brands. His latest book, Brandscaping, Unleashing the Power of Partnerships, is one of Amazon.com's top 100 marketing books. He's produced for Charles Kuralt and MTV. He even produced a documentary film called Roadside Ambition, the amazing true story of one small town with two huge balls. In 2001, Andrew co-founded Tipping Point Labs, where as chief strategy officer, Andrew and his team helped companies like Putnam Investments, Breville, and TomTom. They built digital strategies for publishers like Rodale and Meredith. For more than a decade, Drew has led the charge to change the way publishers think and how brands market their products in a digital world. Andrew, welcome to On Brand.
Hey, thanks, Nick. This is fun. I'm excited to do this.
You know, I usually, after reading the bio there, I always ask for what's some fun fact that's not in the bio, but your bio is chocked full of fun facts, and as an interviewer who may never get another chance to ask this question, I have to lead off with, tell me about the Muppets.
The Muppets were fun. I mean, the Muppet working at the Jim Henson Company was my dream job. So, you know, basically I spent the first 5 or 6 years of my career trying to get a job at the Jim Henson Company. So when I got there, I was kind of in awe. I had finally, hit the big time for me. And this is what I really wanted to do. So it was a blast. I worked in the workshop, which is where they made the puppets. So I was basically in charge of the boring stuff, for the workshop, which was the budget and the production schedule for movies like Muppets from Space and Elmo and Grouchland and, television shows like Bear in the Big Blue House. I don't know if you remember that one.
I think I do. I have five kids, and I think some of I had kids at the time of that great big bear and his blue house.
Yeah, that was a great show. So yeah, it was a lot of fun, and I mean, I learned a ton, not just about about television and puppets and Muppets, but I learned a lot about marketing actually there. So it was a great experience, and it turned out that. It wasn't really my dream job, but it was a really great step along the way. I ended up not really loving the job. It was a difficult time for the Jim Henson Company. It was like the late 90s, and they hadn't produced anything great in a long time. So they're back on their way now that they're owned by Disney.
You know, that's as I was thinking about asking my loaded Muppet question, I was thinking about, you know, Disney is also kind of back. I mean, they've never really... But they've had some struggles for certain, Disney, but their new strategy interests me because they've almost, you know, in addition to upping their own game, they're acquiring so many of the best entertainment brands, from the Muppets to Marvel, yeah, and everything else. It's an interesting strategy because it's really one through brand acquisition.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, there's only a few ways to grow when you're that big. and I think Disney's strategy is pretty smart. Some brands like Marvel, I think they've bought at the top of their game, brands that are kind of expanding and really getting exciting and capitalizing on the audience and fan base that's been built over generations, really. And then there are other brands like the Jim Henson Company that I think I think at the time was pretty much a disaster. In fact, you know, when it comes to brands, the Jim Henson Company's biggest asset were all the puppets that they created. You know, the Elmos and the, you know, Statler and Waldorf, the two guys that sit in the balcony on the Muppet Show, and you know, Grover. And what happened actually to generate revenue in the 90s, when the content wasn't that great, they were over licensing the product, so they were selling the brand to anyone that would buy it. And then I think, as a result, kind of, you know, devalued what the Jim Henson Company really provided, which was great entertainment first and foremost. And what Disney's really smart about, and they always have been, they're master marketers. I call them masters of the moment of inspiration. They're really, really smart about creating content so good that it inspires people to buy stuff they didn't know they needed. You know, I just read an article over the holiday season all about you know, the kind of the amazing revenue generated from the movie Frozen. Oh, yeah. You know, no one needed a Frozen character, anything, before the movie came out. And, you know, Disney's really good at merchandising and marketing as a result of great content. But they put the content first. And that's what's really amazing about them.
You know, the other interesting point in your bio is your work with Charles Kuralt. So what would you tell us about that?
Well, Charles, I mean, for a lot of people don't know Charles Kuralt. You know, I go around the country speaking to people all the time, and I ask audiences if they know Charles Kuralt, and it's usually the older generation that recognizes Charles Kuralt. But he was basically America's, I don't know, pop folklorists or something. Yeah. I don't know what to call him. Yeah, he was a great storyteller, and he told like everyday American stories, and he was kind of famous for driving across the country and just you know, stopping into a little town and then meeting the people and telling these really compelling emotional stories. And so I had the opportunity to work with him very late in his career. It was in the mid-90s, and he had started a show called An American Moment. And basically what he did was find these kind of treasured American icons that people had forgotten about and retold their stories. And I was a producer and writer for An American Moment, which was a really great experience. So he was really a guy that challenged you to tell a story no one had heard, or even if you were going to tell, you know, talk about something that everybody thought they knew about. So, you know, everything from like one of my favorite stories was actually writing all about this, the world's first steam powered automobile, which was actually created in Massachusetts. It was called the Stanley Steamer, and it was a really great, cool story. And we did the story on the 100th anniversary of the invention of the car, and we had these like five remaining Stanley Steamers that still work come out. So, you know, but he was really a guy that challenged you to write an unbelievably emotional story, not just tell me the facts and get me emotionally involved. And I think that's what I learned with him. And a really smart guy.
Yeah, and I'd have to, you know, I'll jump ahead from the past to the more recent future. But I'd say that your work with, you know, Kuralt style storytelling, and I've long since been a young old man, so CBS Sunday Morning is a
yes.
Big day for me. So
yes, me too,
and has been so definitely. I know and love.
I think every marketer should watch CBS Sunday Morning.
Oh, man. I mean, there's some stuff that, I mean, there's at least a third of it that is 100% relevant to what we do.
It's so true.
And there's another third that, if you take a step back and think about it, it's more true than you'd think it is. And the other third is just plain fun that I think can inspire
That's right.
you in another way. So,
I think it's really great food for thought. It's appointment television for me, and I watch it live on Sunday mornings. I don't usually record it, and I find it to be very contemplative time for me. I watch every segment with you know, kind of the eyes of a really naive, I don't know. It feels very old fashioned. So I think you're right, but it is really great storytelling too.
Well, you think about that, how many things are appointment television? For me, there's not that many.
No, that's right.
But that has remained that way. And I don't know why, because you could watch it in the middle of the week and it'd still be.
Yeah, of course.
But I think it's kind of perfectly timed for that Sunday morning ritual. I mean, it occurs when it should. So
that's right. And the content fits the time. Yeah, very much so. It's, I grab my coffee, and instead of reading the newspaper anymore, I watch CBS Sunday Morning.
Yeah, and I mean, I know that it's inspired blog posts, emails to the rest of the team.
That's right.
all kinds of other things. But I was going to say that I would have to think that your work with Kuralt-style storytelling is reflected in your new podcast project, Claim Your Fame.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I wish it was that good at this point, but I'm working towards that. I'm glad you can see the the origins. But yeah, I mean, I decided, you know, I'm a huge fan of podcasts. Obviously, I spend a lot of time on the road listening to podcasts on airplanes and in cars, driving wherever. And so I consume a lot of them. But I really, you know, some of the ones I enjoy the most are kind of NPR style podcasts or NPR shows themselves that I just happen to listen to as podcasts on demand. And I wanted to take the, you know, kind of my storytelling experience with people like Charles Kuralt and you know, working even on the Today Show, and combine it with you know, the NPR style shows that I liked to create a more marketing and business oriented podcast. And so that's what Claim Your Fame is. You know, I'm trying to tell stories about people who have turned their passion and personality into tremendous profit. So it's been a lot of fun. The first episode has just launched a few weeks ago, and I'm sure by the time you're listening to this, maybe there's another one out. But right now it's monthly because it's a little bit, you know, it's harder to produce than I expected, actually. But I'm having a really good time, and I do hope it eventually lives up to a CBS style, you know, Sunday Morning experience for the people that listen to it.
You know, I've try not to gush, but I'm a huge fan of the show for that reason, because I think I put this in my iTunes review, which is a subtle review a reminder to everyone listening to go give your favorite podcasts, including Andrew's and mine own, some love over on iTunes. But I think in my review I said I really listen to those two kinds of pod. I listen to marketing podcasts, you know. Social Pros, This Old Marketing, all Marketing Smarts, all the same ones that we all do. And then I, too, listen to all of these NPR shows that have a very different production style, and I've never seen kind of that Venn diagram overlap like this before. So I'm a huge fan for that reason, and also probably because of the CBS Sunday Morning thought. But in thinking about, you know, because you've mentioned it being monthly, and talked about, you know, that being because of the intense production behind it, I was also thinking, in an era where we're producing so much content, I don't know that that's a thing to maybe, you know, wring your hands about.
No, I don't think it is. I mean, I think at the end of the day, you know, I felt guilty about it. And in fact, you know, I partnered with the Content Marketing Institute to distribute the podcast, which is great because it gives me access to an audience. And that's what, like, Brandscaping, my book, is all about, partnering with other people to gain access to the audience. And, you know, Content Marketing Institute was really concerned about the frequency being so infrequent in a digital age where there's more and more content. But I'm really of the mindset that what we really need is not necessarily more content, but more better content. We're kind of all hitting information overload. And what I really like to do is just make an appointment with my audience once a month to consume some really great, high quality content that inspires you to think differently, and something you can really chew on. And, you know, I think so far it's working. You know, for me, I try to measure the impact of the content I'm creating by the number of subscribers I get, people who are interested in committing to getting the content on a regular basis, not just, you know, the number of people that listen to episode one or two or three. And to me, that's the most valuable metric. So when I'm inviting people to subscribe to once a month content, it's they if they've enjoyed the first one, they know they're not going to remember next week or tomorrow to check it out. Mm-hmm. You know, I think they sign up in a larger quantity when they know the frequency is not as frequent as they normally expect. And they know they're making a commitment to a small amount of content once a month instead of a daily email or another weekly email or another RSS feed to add. So I think right now it's working to my advantage. I would like to up the frequency eventually, but I think it's only if the audience really demands it, you know. If they say, I wish there were more of these, then let's do it.
Well, plus, I think, you know, we talked about appointment television. I mean, I think of it like an appointment podcast, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got, you know, probably a couple dozen on my podcast app, and I'm not able to keep up with the most recent episode of all of them. But yours is sitting there. It's, you know, it's very motivational from the audience standpoint because I know I've got that covered. And
that's right.
But it's also kind of, you know, in this obligatory serial reference, but in this time where, you know, they're teaching listeners to consume podcasts differently. I mean, they, on the other end of the extreme, you know, had all of this binge listening.
Sure.
But then very consciously put together a season that started, had an arc, and is done.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, there's all these best practices of, you know, getting a show out every week. And I say that sitting here from a show, you know, that is weekly as well. That's a part of that huge crowded stream. And I think that you can, as the medium grows, I think people can do different things with the time as well. You know, some pushing it to the extreme of, you know, daily, as a few do, and then others producing, you know, you talk about so much content, but if there's a different show, and maybe in some ways, I think an even better show that's worth the wait.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, I talk about appointment consumption a lot with you know, people I know. And the idea is that, you know, we talked about appointment viewing with CBS Sunday Morning and appointment television. And, you know, the concept there was that you would kind of plan your TV watching schedule around the shows when they were on because you didn't have a DVR and you couldn't get stuff on demand. And today I think appointment consumption is driven more by the content producer, where they define a time in which and kind of suggest when you should consume the content so that you make an appointment even in your mind, you know, as to what triggers what kind of content consumption. So, you know, a lot of podcasts are either listened to on a treadmill or listened to on a commute. You know, if you're going to create a podcast and most people work out for 40 to 47 minutes, well, then creating a 37-minute podcast is going to work great. And even if you define it as, hey, the morning social brand chat workout, then that's a trigger. When they go to work out, they should listen to your podcast. And I think those kinds of things make a big impact on the ability of the audience to make time to cut through that information overload of, you know, the 40 podcasts I've got sitting there waiting that to listen to. And, you know, I've even we did it when I was with Tipping Point, even with airplane stuff. So you would say we basically called we had some it was actually printed material that we called One Flight Insight, and it was meant for high-level CMOs at consumer brands. And the idea was that you could read this in the time that the doors close on the airplane and before you get to 10,000 feet, that like 35 minutes that it takes to taxi and take off generally. And we targeted assistants, their assistant, to print it out and put it in their, you know, the CMO's briefcase so that they read it on the plane. And it was really unbelievably effective because we helped define the time. Like, you've got nothing else to do right now. In the old days, your electronic device had to be off. Why don't you read this piece of paper that somebody printed out for you? And it worked really well. So I think the more we think about creating content and defining the time, the more successful we'll be.
You know, you talked a bit about partnerships and the role that they play in, you know, you launch and claim your fame. And that is, you know, a big focus of brandscaping. Can you talk a little bit about how, you know, kind of your take on how brands can best leverage partnerships?
Sure. Well, I think the central question around partnerships is really thinking strategically about who you should partner with. And the idea, if you just want to sum it up in one statement, is starting to ask yourself, who has your next customer as their current customer? So if you start thinking about all the brands that you know, your audience purchases before they buy what you sell, those are great people to partner with. And the commodity you can use to start partnering with them is content, because everybody needs content these days to keep up with their social streams, to provide their audience with value that's adding value to their lives. And if you're creating great content for the same audience, then starting to partner together to share that content becomes a real opportunity. opportunity to kind of join the brands together so that you build a relationship with those new customers even before they need you. So like, let's say you sell like, accounting software. Well, the first thing, you know, when you're setting up a business that you buy is probably not accounting software. You probably buy a printer and a laptop and a Rolodex if you're old. I don't know what you buy, but it's not, you don't sit down and say, well, the first thing I'm going to do is buy some accounting software. So if you've partnered with Staples, right, or an office supply store or a printer company and started providing people with, insight that would help them after they've purchased that product to understand how you can benefit from using that product for accounting purposes, then your brand is going to be top of mind when they say, well, shoot, I do need an accounting software now because I just got my first check for a job I did. What do I do with it? So that's the kind of thinking. Can you find the people that need you by looking through the other brands they already purchase? Does that make sense?
It does. It does. And even from kind of the beginning there where you said you talked about thinking strategically about your partnerships too, and that kind of even a simple thought like that, here's an elementary question. Are people pretty sloppy with their partnerships?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think the problem with partnerships is we think of them as sponsorships, like short-lived, slap my logo on your webpage or slap my logo on your event, on a big sign. And, that's what people see as a partnership today. I think the partnerships that are going to be successful in the future are long-term partnerships designed to benefit both brands. And they go much deeper than, slapping your logo on an email newsletter and say, we're now partnered with whoever, right? Nick and Drew are now partnered. That doesn't mean much. But if I start sharing, the most simple, brandscape is when this episode of the podcast comes out and you say, hey, Drew, it just came out, and I start sharing with that with my audience, well, now all of a sudden my audience is now exposed to your podcast. That's the most authentic kind of endorsement. And if we were going to create a really great partnership, it would be, hey, Nick, tell me when yours come out. I'll tell you when mine come out. We're both obviously going after the same audience. And let's do a better job of integrating, our content schedule. So I have something of value to share and you have something of value to share in a really authentic way.
Yeah. I mean, I think, the most partnerships result from a couple of organizations have kind of circled and sniffed one another and haven't found an immediate buck. So they say, we'll be partners, and then nothing really comes of it in terms of what we're doing and how we're going to, specific strategy like you just outlined there.
Yeah, I mean, the goal has to be that both of you are going to make more money as a result, really. Yes. A partnership just for fun isn't really that helpful, but it can be fun. I think the real goal is like, hey, look, if I can convert some of, the social brand podcast, fans into Claim Your Fame podcast fans, then that's a great partnership. That essentially is my revenue exchange. And if I can do the same for you, then that's great. So, if every episode of my podcast, I said, hey, if you want to listen to another brand, great podcast, listen to Nick's podcast, that's a really great partnership.
Well, and I think also you talking about thinking strategically with, who has your next customer and how you can connect with them. And then the question that I think, where so many drop the ball is, okay, so what do we do? And I think content, bridging that gap with content makes a lot of sense. And it reminds me of our mutual friend Anne Handley, who often talks about the importance of being a content brand rather than a brand with content.
Yep. But I talk about the same thing. Yeah. It's just very, I think that's the at the end of the day, the question you're trying to answer for the partner is, what can I do to help you? And if you just sit down and have a conversation like that, look, we both understand that we're going after the same audience. What can I do to help you? I already have an email database. I already have an email list. I mean, that's an audience ready to hear your message. What can we do to work together in the right way? And the easiest thing to do is say, let's share some content on a regular basis with each other's audience.
And, you know, bridging that gap with content and, you know, in Anne's words, being a content brand rather than a brand with content, I think that is a struggle for many as well, you know, because most brands haven't, you know, are struggling to keep up with all the content we need to create. What do you recommend there?
Well, I mean, it's a nuance, and it's going to sound convoluted after hearing, you know, your Anne Hanley quote. But essentially, I tell people to create content brands instead of branded content. And the difference for me is branded content is created for the company, with a very specific goal or purpose in mind at the end of the day. And a content brand is created for an audience, and it's designed to attract an audience first, build a relationship with that audience first, and then drive revenue second. And if you're focused on creating great content for an audience and building that relationship, what you end up with is an audience ready to buy what you sell at the end of the day, but also increasing demand for lots of other products. So, podcasts are actually good examples because Everybody brands their podcast. It's really interesting. You know, mine's branded Claim Your Frame. Marketing Profs has theirs. I forget what theirs is
marketing
branded.
Marketing Smarts. Well, it's
Marketing Smarts. There you go. So that's a content brand. But we don't do that when it comes to most of our text content. You know, we just push out blog posts every single day. And there's, you know, they're very inconsistent. I don't know the quality is going to be good every single day. You get spikes and valleys. But if you branded once a week, a specific piece of content for a very specific audience and build that content brand first, you'll be much more successful over the long term.
I think podcasts too, in addition to all of their other benefits, like you said, lend themselves to being content brands a little better. And I don't know if that's, you know, that the medium feels like internet radio, so maybe you feel like you have more of a show because, I mean, Claim Your Fame has an obvious brand and show to it. My previous podcast, The Work Talk Show, I wanted to do something different as opposed to just, this is the brand driven digital podcast. I went with On Brand because it reminded me of the public radio of On Point too. So,
oh, right.
It just felt a little more.
What's interesting about this? Take, there's a company called ShopLocket. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, but basically they sell e-commerce software. Okay, so generally, if you're like a Kickstarter type company, you just started your company, you raised a bunch of money on Kickstarter, and now you're actually selling your product, they sell the bridge product. So between Kickstarter and having like your full on own site. So they're kind of this middle provider. Well, they don't have a podcast, but they created basically an online magazine that comes out every single Wednesday afternoon called The Blueprint. And it is one of the most unbelievably beautiful pieces of a content brand I've ever seen when it comes to a text-driven content brand. It really feels like high-quality, wonderful content. And what they do is showcase other very successful Kickstarters who've made the transition to a business. So they start attracting the audience they want. And those people, I just talked to the guys that write The Blueprint and work for ShopLocket, and they essentially that one piece of content, The Blueprint that comes out every Wednesday, builds a huge subscriber base, and those subscribers have turned into their most successful lead generation tool by far, they said. Like, nothing even comes close to that piece of content's ability to convert people when they're ready to the product they offer. And that's a content brand that's not a podcast, because I think you're right, podcasts feel easy. You know, people see it as a way to create a brand, like a show, like a TV show, like a radio show. But The Blueprint's a great example of someone that's done it in text form that I think everybody should take a look at.
Well, it's interesting because I get hung up too a lot of times on the labels of all of these things. And as much as I love brands and content, it never occurred to me that your definition too of branded content, that it can reinforce some not so great behaviors, that I got to crank out these kind of meaningless blog posts.
That's right.
that versus something that exists for the audience. And it's, like I said, easier with a podcast. I'll find that the Shop Locket blueprint and link up to it, because I think that there's this – that's why I'm kind of led off with, you know, being fascinated with your entertainment background. I mean, obviously not as deep as you, but my formal education was in theater arts and psychology. But I think that, you know, creativity, you know, prepared me for where marketing ended up going. And I think that there's kind of a lot of woe is me among marketers out there that I can't create, you know, a show, you know, any of this interesting content. And I think that, you know, there's all kinds of examples out there that confound that.
Yeah, and I think when you do that, you stop creating content and marketing stuff that's an expense, and you actually turn it into an asset. You know, the blueprint, if you separate the blueprint from Shop Locket, I would buy the blueprint as a magazine brand. I mean, I would if I was a magazine publisher, I would approach those people and say, "Look, what you've built here is unbelievable. Can I buy it for $100,000? I don't know, $30,000, something, because it's that valuable. The brand, the content, the resource you've created, and the audience you've garnered is worth something separate, even from the business you actually run." That's the approach more and more marketers need to take. Because when you do that, you actually are creating an asset that's got intellectual property, and I guarantee your CFO will love you, because you can actually stop looking at your marketing just as an expense, and you can actually put a line item in every year's financial statement that looks at it as an asset. Like when I talked to the guy's name is Dan, by the way, that runs the blueprint, and when I talked to him, I asked him to kind of characterize the brand they've built. What is the blueprint? And he essentially told me it's Wired Magazine meets Vice meets Inside the Actor's Studio for hardware entrepreneurs. Well, like, that's genius.
Well, and I think that's, you know, it's not rocket surgery either. I mean,
no.
you take a definition like that, which, you know, sounds like, oh, well, that's really doable and logical, but I even back that up to what you're doing too. You take an NPR style production and marketing content,
exactly,
and mash it up. And it's funny because my top secret one was I wanted to do something about branding with more of a long form interview, Charlie Rose kind of style to it. But
there you go.
No one's Charlie Rose. But
no one is Charlie Rose. That is for sure. But that's, so I call that a hook, right? So
yeah.
You need to have a simple twist on a familiar theme that people can identify with, and that kind of ensnares or entraps them. It makes them feel this is very different, and it's also the way generally people will try to describe it to others. So if I said, "Hey, have you ever read The Blueprint?" And you said no, I might say, "Oh man, it's awesome. It's like Wired Magazine meets Vice Magazine, but kind of Inside the Actor's Studio interviews, you know, for hardware entrepreneurs." And that all of a sudden paints this mental picture in your mind, and really, you know, positions it as something very different, and that carves out a space in your world of content that you're constantly asked to consume as something that maybe is unique and is worth your time. And I think the more we think like that, building content brands like the Blueprint, the more successful we'll be.
Yeah, I mean, and those hooks, you're creating content brands by kind of hooking into those other established content brands, because you know,
exactly,
you know what the Actor's Studio is.
Yeah, so this is what I learned in television, right? When you're pitching TV shows to a network, they always will tell you, "I want something new, I want something unique, I want something crazy." And the more crazy and new and unique you got, the less interested they were. What they wanted you to walk in and say, it's basically the X Factor with a twist, or it's just like American Idol, but it's got a little twist, right? And that's when they're like, "I love it. It's brand new. It's innovative. It's great." And that's, funnily enough, it's the same way the audience builds a relationship with the content. You know, they do want new things, but they want to be able to identify with it and grow with it over time. So the hook helps you do that. And mashups is one of the easiest ways to come up with a hook. Like Gary Vaynerchuk's, you know, Wine Library TV, that hook is essentially wine, you know, wine tasting meets sports center, You know, that's just a mashup. It's like, is, you know, it's basically a radio talk show about sports, but they talk about wine instead. You know, and that's what gave it a unique feel. It wasn't just a wine snob show. He could have done a sports talk show about the Jets, I'm sure, but instead he had a really great wine show that that men identified with.
Well, before we wind down, I want to leave some time to talk about your new book, because we did that that ultimate interview sin where you start in on something really interesting before you hit record, and I had to rudely say you have to stop because I want to know more about this, but I want to tell all the listeners. So tell us a bit about the next Andrew Davis book.
Oh man, the next Andrew Davis book is called Town Inc. And the subtitle is Grow Your Business, Save Your Town, Leave Your Legacy. And it's been a really fun journey. Over the last 3 years, I visited about 50 towns and cities across the United States. And my goal was to figure out why some were booming and others were bust. And, you know, I thought I'd find that they had some cool economic development program or really cool tax incentive or some smart startup hub idea. But it looked like that wasn't the case, actually. I started finding that these towns that were known for something very unique became these standouts. So Warsaw, Indiana, for example, is the orthopedic capital of the world. And they are unbelievably successful. It's like an oasis in the middle of the Rust Belt. You drive in there and it's all of a sudden fountains and big buildings. And it's essentially about a third of all orthopedic revenue from the world goes through this little town. There, three of the five largest orthopedic manufacturers are based there, and it's got this just amazing heritage and history that backs up the claim. And so, I found, Hamilton, Missouri is the quick quilting capital of the world. And it's basically this woman, Jenny Doan, started putting up YouTube videos on how to, you know, quick quilt, which means make a quilt faster than a year. And all of a sudden she had fans all over the world that were coming to visit Hamilton, Missouri. And now she's the largest employer in the county. And her business is growing by leaps and bounds. 50,000 people come visit her little store. It called Missouri Star Quilting Company. And what's interesting about these is it's kind of tomorrow's Henry Fords and Hewlett Packards. And, you know, they're basically marketing the place they do business as much as they are marketing the business they do there. And all of a sudden it has this amazing ability to bring a town together to all kind of focus on growing in a very specific way. And not surprisingly, there's kind of some key elements you have to have to make this work. You need a great origin story, and you actually have to kind of tap into the myths of the place, and it creates location envy. So it's been a really, really fun time, and I'm excited for it. It should be out in early 2015.
I'm really excited to look at that. Our first guest on this show is Patrick Hanlon, who wrote a book called Primal Branding that talks about what he identifies as seven pieces of primal code, one of which is a creation story. And, you know, it's a great concept, but, you know, the thing he points out is, you know, not all brands have all of these pieces of primal code working for them, but the best brands usually do. And I think that, you know, the kind of those, you know, exemplary brands, many of them, like you said, with Henry Ford, other examples, have this sense of place. And that's not always a piece of the story that many brands capitalize on. But if you do, it can enrich it even further, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it turns out there are three types of origin stories that almost any company and town or place can embrace. They might not embrace all three, but one of the three kind of become crucial. So it's essentially, one can be a kind of a historic one. Those are very easy generally, which, you know, like in Warsaw, Indiana, the orthopedic capital of the world, a guy named Reverend Dupuy in 1896 or something started the first orthopedic manufacturing company in the world in this little town in a hotel room, and basically was trying to sell fiber splints to people who came out of the Civil War. So like, that's the historic aspect, right? Then there's a a second kind, which is basically a geographic anomaly. It's taking advantage of the fact that there's something in or near or that defines the town you live in that doesn't exist anywhere else in the world and that you can take advantage of. So, for example, Arcata, California is actually the marijuana capital of the world, but it also happens to be a great place to you know, grow any product almost. It's all sorts of really amazing stuff. Everything from, they make great cheese there called Humboldt Fog, by the way. But the reason weed and cheese grow great there is because they have the redwoods. So the same things that make the redwoods, the tallest trees in the world, grow to these amazing proportions is the same thing that makes great weed and unbelievably good cheese and great beer. And it ends up being a series of rivers and stuff. But that's a geographic anomaly. And the last one is essentially the myth, and these are actually fairly common. But if you like Muscle Shoals, Alabama is the hit record capital of the world, and in the 60s, 70s, and even the early 80s, a lot of the number one songs on the radio were actually recorded in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, which is this little town in northern Alabama. And it was because there was this Native American legend that a princess was singing by the river, and every day you would be inspired to hear this princess singing for her lover, and it would change the way you sing yourself and the kind of music you write. So everyone from Aretha Franklin to the Rolling Stones to Bob Dylan to even Alicia Keys have gone there to embody this myth and then go record in these studios to come up with another number one hit. So those are the three types of origin stories that I found are very effective in creating a sense of place, because anyone can go to LA and record in a studio, but you can only get that aura that you get in Muscle Shoals because of that myth, that legend that people really do believe.
Well, and like you said, I think that for the region as a whole too, like you talk, it's the easy one to remember, but the weed example, but it carries over to the rest of the community though, because it's not just, you know, you have your jokes and everything else, but beyond that, you know, you've got a story about agriculture and the land, and
that's right. Well, even so Arcata has really embraced this idea, and there's a company called Los Bagels, which they call themselves a Mexican Jewish deli, and they're located in, you know, Humboldt County. And when you ask them what makes their bagels so good, they claim it's the water, from the same water that grows the redwoods, the same water that makes great weeds, the same water that the sheep you know, drink to make this amazing cheese, makes these unbelievably good bagels. So good that people from Manhattan order overnight delivery of these bagels. So like those origin stories become, they permeate the community, and they also help define the place. So if I was going to start an organic farm of some sort, you know, Humboldt County would be one of the first places I think of moving, because I'm going to be more successful there than anywhere else in the country, unless it was sugar beets, because Fargo, North Dakota is the sugar beet capital of the world.
Now I know that. I have so many new capitals of the world that I've scrolled down for random road tripping, which I'm sure will be another fun alternate use of That's Town right. Inc., which we're all looking forward to.
Yay!
As we wrap up, what brand has made you smile lately?
I would say, Lord. Well, you know what? You know who makes me smile a lot is actually a company called Trunk Club. I don't know if you do you know them?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So Trunk Club, for those of you that don't know, they basically provide guys like me who don't like to shop with the ability to basically get a trunk sent to me, a box sent to me with some new clothes that I can try on and keep whatever I like, and whatever I don't like, I just send back. But what's interesting is it's a really great connection to a person at the brand. So my stylist, I did air quotes right there, by the way, Nick.
Okay, I'll note that for the show notes.
That's right. My stylist, her name's Sarah Baker, and I don't really know her, but I've built a relationship with her because she always writes a handwritten note in the trunk that I get from her. And I really feel like it's a great personal experience. And every time I open these boxes, I smile. I smile at the fact that Sarah's thought about me and thought about the fact that I might be going to a New Year's party and has provided me with a new shirt and, you know, something that's going to look great for to bring in 2015. And, you know, I don't know if she writes the same note to every other of her stylist clients, but I really do open the box and smile at a handwritten note.
Yeah, handwritten notes are big for the smiles. So
they are
so often missed. Well, where can folks go to learn more about who you are, what you do, and where they
sure. Yeah, the best place to learn, well, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at TPLDrew, and that's a great and easy way to get a hold of me and stay in touch. And you can certainly find me at youvebeendrewed.com. So anyone that's listening to the podcast, feel free to sign up. I have 6 weeks of inspirational videos that I'll send you, one a week. It's called Inspiration Over Lunch. Talk about appointment consumption. I'm trying to define lunch as a good time to eat your sandwich and watch me yell at you for 7 minutes. Or you can find me at AKA Drew Davis if you're just looking for what the hell I am and who I'm about.
All right. Well, we will link up to all of those. Drew, thank you for being on brand with us.
Hey, thanks. This has been great. I really appreciate it. It's so much fun chatting with you. Thanks, Nick.
And finally, I want to give a shout, speaking of partnerships, to a great mentor of this podcast with a resource that you should know more about. Jay Baer, our mutual friend over at Convince and Convert, has done it again. In addition to being a digital marketing thought leader, speaker, and best-selling author, he's now created a new online resource indexing all of the great marketing podcasts out there. It's called, wait for it, Marketing Podcasts.
Podcast. It's awesome.
And you can find it at marketingpodcasts.com. If you like marketing, if you like podcasts, you need to check this out. Last, but certainly not least, you can find show notes and links at branddrivendigital.com. You can subscribe to the show via iTunes, Stitcher, and RSS. Speaking of iTunes, second mention here within this show, but if you like what you're hearing on this show or any other podcast or great content brand out there, be sure to hop over to iTunes, click that little 5-star button, give the show a rating, drop in a few quick sentences for a review. It helps out podcasters like Drew and myself. Don't forget that this podcast is brought to you by our Brand Driven Digital Event Series. Learn more about Twitter Brand Basics, Digital Strategy Bootcamp, and the industry-leading Social Brand Forum now. Until next week, I'm Nick Westergaard, and I'll see you on the internet.
This has been the On Brand Podcast, presented by Brand Driven Digital. For show notes, links, and more, go to onbrandpodcast.com. Remember, you can subscribe to the show and leave a rating and review at iTunes and Stitcher. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.